This episode of The Review was first broadcast on the 17th of March 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24, with me, Emma Nelson, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll find out what booksellers are seeing flying off their shelves in bookshops in Sao Paulo, Dubai and Glasgow.
It's not old-fashioned looking in the sense that it's all dark wood and everything, but there are books. Higgledy-piggledy, I think, is the word.
We'll also be listening to some new music, courtesy of Thomas Young from Iceland Music Export.
And we'll be flicking through the pages of our favourite magazines with Will Hudson, editor of It's Nice That.
All that to come right here on The Review on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House.
Hello, Sophie.
How are you this morning?
I haven't seen you for absolutely ages in this room, and it's lovely to have you in here. And it's lovely to be together on this wonderful, slightly different programme that we've been doing as of late.
I know, it feels like a real treat.
It is. It's a cup of coffee, papers ready. Not entirely sure what's going to happen in the next hour, but not massively worried about that because I'm sure we'll meander our way through publications and nice things and nice treats.
And we don't normally get cocooned in here from the hammering rain outside of London.
And someone appears to have turned the lights off as well. So whether we will be able to read what we're supposed to be doing for the next hour is completely questionable.
This is known as atmospheric lighting.
It's lovely. Listeners, it's atmospheric. We have a few papers to look through before we start going on. Actually, no, let's have a look at what we're going to be doing for the rest of the programme. We're going to take our usual tour of bookshops. Where are we going this week?
So we're going to Sao Paulo, which is going to be interesting, Dubai and also Glasgow.
I wonder what they're buying in Glasgow.
I know, I do too. It's great to get a little insight into independent bookshops and really see what's hot there.
Fame
it's
for much the bloody murderous novel of the Scots, aren't they?
How could you say that?
Well, you get your sort of your Ian Rankins, and one would possibly argue that Scotland has, as of late, become more associated with the popular murder mystery. I'm not quite sure. I am absolutely willing to be proved wrong that the Glaswegians are doing something else.
Possibly they might be buying cookbooks because, as we saw from the Michelin stars this week that were published, they're actually doing super well. Not Glasgow, but Edinburgh. But maybe they're trying to beat their neighbours and running out and buying cookbooks.
So possibly we'll be exploring whether the Scots are preoccupied with knives and all their particular uses.
We might be. Well, stay tuned to hear what the Scots are buying.
We'll also be going to Iceland, or Iceland will be coming to us.
They will.
A gentleman called Thomas Young from Iceland Music Export, he will be bringing a few of his favourite tunes in. And he'll also be talking about the Icelandic music scene, which, if you were listening a few moments ago, our co-presenter Andrew Muller was quite scathing about in its present state. He said it had a heyday of the 90s, following up after Bjork and all that. And everybody jumped on the bandwagon and everybody went to Reykjavik, got drunk, and then the money ran out and then the music got not so bad. So we'll be taking him to task about whether Icelandic music is still as good as it was.
Fantastic. I'm glad to see you've already come up with some formidable questions
as usual. Yes, I shall probe. Instead of enjoying Icelandic music, I'll be saying, is it as good as it was?
This is meant to be a relaxing Saturday.
I'll have my foot on Mr. Young's windpipe within 5 minutes. What's in the papers?
Well, I'm looking at the cover of the FT Weekend, mainly because George Clooney was arrested yesterday. And even when he's being arrested, he still looks dashing.
He has poise, doesn't he?
He does. He gets
manacled quite well.
He's got quite a nice profile. He was protesting, to his credit, out in Washington about Sudan and against Omar al-Bashir, the president there. So he's really sort of sacrificed his wonderful self for that cause.
This is a beautiful sacrifice, and we're very grateful to Mr. Clooney for it. He was released a couple of hours later, but it's an incredibly clever little ploy because having been at the Obama dinner the night before and having such this brilliantly accessible profile, all he needs to do is turn up somewhere and the eyes of the world suddenly focus in a way that many other campaigners just simply don't get the oxygen.
I mean, he is obviously very aware how much he as a personality, can just do that.
Oh, his
and
value
shift that
is
gaze.
Very high.
I mean, it's cynical, but it works.
It works so a treat.
It's interesting, and we'll see how. I mean, I don't think he's going to spend much time behind bars
doing porridge. Clooney doing porridge isn't the idea that I think is going to last too long. His father was there as well, which I always find amazing that there's this sort of dual persona of George Clooney that many people say, you know, he's just got another beautiful woman on his arm everywhere he goes. Yet he then takes his dad along to the serious stuff. I quite like that.
I know, that's lovely.
I have an amazing article in Le Monde from this weekend. They've discovered an article, a manifesto written by Albert Camus in 1939, a couple of weeks after the beginning of the Second World War. And what he basically does is an article that should have been published in Algiers, the country of Camus' birth, and where he was working at the time for a small newspaper. And what Camus does is sets out the sort of manifesto for a wartime journalist. And anybody who has a little bit of time should really devote themselves to reading about this, because it has really, really modern and very, very actual current relevance. He says that there are four important things that a free journalist should be able to do, which is be clear, be have the ability to say no to publishing things, having the sense of irony in order, you know, and able to step back, and also to be obstinate, to really push on. And his most important thing, he says, for freedom of expression is for the ability to not include certain things, because not including certain things in what you write about can basically say more about what the subject is actually concerning. Does that kind of make sense, or am I not making sense?
As a sort of as a teaser.
Yes.
The ability to
sort of say no to what you're supposed, what pressure from external pressure might want you to include in something. By leaving certain things out, you let your reader decide what they really think.
And what a find. I mean,
astonishing. Yeah.
You would have thought everything Camus wrote would have been unearthed by now, but that really sounds like it has some interesting sort of pointers even for us. So
absolutely. It is,
thank you.
Yeah, it's all right. The Monde is saying this is a reflection on journalism in the time of war, and more widely about individual freedom of expression and choice. Quite an amazing article if you do have time to read it. Let's move on though to what we are normally doing at this time of the hour on the Monocle Review. We start today, as ever, with a trio of bookshops from around the world to hear what's been selling well this past week.
First up, we visit Pedro Hertz in Sao Paulo.
My name is Pedro Hertz. I'm the CEO of the company. It's a small chain of 13 bookstores, started more than 60 years ago by my mother. She started lending books. She thought that many books were worth to be read and not to be bought. This was the very beginning. Then the readers of that lending library asked her to start to sell books, because someone liked that book very much, and a birthday was of a relative was soon. It was a nice present to be given. So, and then she started to sell the books. And actually, at that moment, the bookstore starts. The philosophy is we sell content, different medias. Books, which is our main product we sell, it's about 65-70% of our sales are books, and then the rest is music, films, and magazines. And then in 1969, we moved to this building here where we are in Avenida Paulista, and the lending library stops. The most sold book, the A Parisiense, it's in Portuguese, it's number one on our list in Portuguese. Viagens na Minha Terra is number two from Almeida Garré. It's a Portuguese writer. É Tudo Tão Simples, Danusa Leão. She is a Brazilian. José de Alencar is a classic. Drummond de Andrade is a famous Brazilian poet. It goes so quickly and changes so quickly, because if a book arrives, let's say 500 copies, in the morning at lunchtime, it may change.
And that was Pedro Hertz from Livraria Cultura in Sao Paulo.
Next up, we head to Glasgow to visit Young's Interesting Books.
My name is Barry Young, and you're very welcome to my bookshop here in the south side of Glasgow. This is Young's Interesting Books in Skirving Street, and we've been here 2 years now. And it's a wonderful little street full of little cafes and independent shops. and it is the perfect place really for a bookshop in the south side, and as we're the only one, we've been doing quite well. So if you want to come inside, I'll show you around. It's not a big shop, as you can see, but I think what we're trying to do here is to be friendly and small, and I suppose cosy is the word. It's not old-fashioned looking in the sense that it's all dark wood and everything, but there are books, higgledy-piggledy, I think is the word, piled up, and even though we try and sort them out into good categories and things like that, it does tend to be a bit shambolic, especially as we get new stock in, of course. If you come over the window, I'll give you an idea of what we do. We try and change the window, obviously, quite a lot, but what happens, of course, is that people tend to buy things straight out of the window, which means that you're left with holes in your display, which you fill. So sometimes when you have a beautiful display, Christmas being the obvious one in point, I think this year I had about 5 different displays that, as I was putting them up, people were buying the centrepieces off as they saw them in the window. But this one at the moment, I suppose we've got a joyous display of paper sculptures just now, which were done by a friend of mine who's got a shop just up the road, a little design shop, and he took some of our old, battered and sadly neglected books and turned them into magnificent sculptures. We've got one where there's a tree growing out with little bits of furniture being blown around in the wind. We have hot air balloons made out of books. We've got roses and flowers and snowflakes and all sorts of wonderful things. So we just build something around that. At the moment, we've got a lot of Glasgow books in the window. We've got some nice ones about the old trades. Here, The Hammermen, History of the Hammermen of Glasgow, which I think is a wonderful title for a book, but it's really just about the engineering trade in the city. We have an old photograph album, a beautiful old Victorian photograph album. We have local histories as well, but some nice old penguins. There are certain books which are sort of always fashionable. It's the culty type books, things like, the Beach Poets and some of the Japanese authors now, Murakami and the rest, which are, we always try and keep something in the window for them. I think 96% of all our sales are impulse buys. That is, someone comes in and they see a book that they didn't know they wanted, they didn't know existed perhaps, but when they see it, it's something that either makes a perfect gift for themselves or for a friend or for somebody. We just stumbled across a tattered old paperback of the Rolling Thunder logbook by Sam Shepherd about a Bob Dylan tour of Australia. It was supposed to be a film and never materialised. And I was just thumbing through that, and in the middle, I think on page 119, you had a wonderful inscription, gift inscription from Bob Dylan to an Australian artist. Dylan never signs anything, but this was absolutely authenticated. It was wonderful to stumble across something like that. It's like there was a pamphlet I found in a cupboard in a school just the other week, which was an abridged version of a G.A. Henty adventure story for schoolboys. And it was a little school copy, dog-eared from about 1900, a couple of black and white illustrations, and as rare as hen's teeth, because it's a school book. And of course, they all got destroyed. And Henty lovers are completists, and this was just something that was possibly the only one left, and it was a wonderful thing to find. And that's the joy of it, the stumbling across the strange things.
I think what delighted me about that small piece was that Barry's voice actually accurately mirrored the kind of character of the bookshop that he was trying to portray. I mean, his words, cosy and higgledy-piggledy.
I love higgledy-piggledy.
I like higgledy. And he had a kind of higgledy-piggledy feel, did Barry. I think
it sounds like a great shop.
Absolutely charmed by his nice old penguins and his Bob Dylan finds, and the fact that he found things, pamphlets in cupboards in schools. This is, I think he would be a real find. I did enjoy Barry. Where are we heading now to? Slight change, slight gear change, I'd say.
We're heading to Dubai to visit Jashmahal Books.
My name is Naren Jashmahal. I'm the general manager of JashmahalBooks.com. I've been with the company for 8 years, and we run a chain of 15 bookstores under a variety of different brands, ranging from JashmahalBooks.com stores to the more traditional Jashmahal Books stores. We have a franchise agreement with Relay for our airport stores, which we operate in Abu Dhabi Airport and Bahrain Airport. So we had made the decision about 2 years ago to take bookstores into a new direction for us, moving away from larger format traditional stores to smaller format, more contemporary stores, focusing on still keeping a wide variety of categories, but trying to focus more on front list new release titles in each of those categories. So you'll find the same broad range of categories you would in a traditional bookstore, but on a smaller format footprint, we've decided to focus on just front list titles and a few key backlist titles in the stores. The store format themselves are small. They range at the lower end of about 1,000 square feet, going up to about 3,500 square feet in size. Anticipating that people's reading habits are shifting away from printed books in those categories and towards ebooks, we wanted to open up categories that are more resistant to erosion from digital properties. So we focus on illustrated books, art, design, architecture, photography, graphic novels, so comic books. Magazines are still a very important part of the business. So that's where we're taking the stores. And that, you know, that affects the way you set up your display, that affects the type of graphics, that affects your window displays, it affects a lot of different things, the types of fixtures, and the way you present your books in the stores. Books like Phaidon's The Art Museum is selling particularly well, monographs from different artists as well. The Hunger Games series for our younger readers is doing extremely well with the movie about to come out. And graphic novels, you've got a lot of big movies this year. You've got Batman, you've got Spider-Man. So graphic novel sales are also starting to ramp up for us.
Well, what a change from Barry in Glasgow. That's a market-driven man.
They weren't digging around in jumble sales.
They weren't. They weren't. They had their 1,000 square feet. And obviously they're the first people who are talking about very, very clearly about the move away from, or trying to stop, what was it, the erosion by the iBook. And you just saw that they were incredibly marketing-driven there. I'd love to know actually what they enjoyed reading. I wasn't entirely sure he enjoyed selling books very much.
But it's interesting.
That's possibly me being very disparaging of Narain Jashmal from Jashmal Books.
Also the sort of filmic thing when a film comes out and everyone runs out having watched it to read it.
To read the book.
I've never quite understood that.
Oh no, that is something that is becoming sadly more and more prevalent.
Well, next on the review, we hear some music from Iceland picked for us by Thomas Young. Stay with us.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus our regular Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel, food and retail. This week we highlight bright and shiny hardware at the Singapore Air Show.
China marketed its upcoming C919, while on the smaller end, the Mitsubishi Regional Jet made its cabin mock-up premiere, complete with a sushi bar in the stand. The first commercial jet ever made by a Japanese company, it's another promising model.
This and over 250 more films to be found in the program's menu on monocle.com.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, wants to beckon you onto its intergalactic spaceship of artistic endeavour, zooming you from gallery openings on Mars to concerts on Venus via magazine launches on the outer reaches of the Milky Way. Actually, that's a lie, but it is a truly global mix of art, literature, film, music, media, and the home of the wonderful and well-loved showcase for live music, the Midori House Sessions.
In the backs of buses across Europe and Latin America, we compose a little song.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove and Emma Nelson.
Time now to head for our weekly music review. Today our focus is on Iceland. Joining us on the line is Thomas Young from Reykjavik from Iceland Music Report. A very warm welcome to The Review, Thomas. Warm welcome indeed. Tell us what is setting things on fire in Iceland at the moment in the music scene.
Well, at the moment, I would say the biggest news is a band called Of Monsters and Men. And they won like a Battle of the Bands competition about 2 years ago. And now already they have signed to Universal on a world record deal. And their fan base is getting huge and they've sold over 100,000 copies in the US. And they're actually on tour now, and most of their shows are sold out. And they just arrived to the US for the first time.
So your job at the moment with Iceland, with your job at the moment, excuse me, focuses very much on exporting Icelandic music, doesn't it? Is it still exporting as well as it did a couple of decades ago?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, we still have the big players like Björk and Sigur's dominating, really, but I think what has changed is that we have more smaller bands, which I think is like a global thing. I think most countries, I think, can say the same, that they're boasting, you know, more artists that are doing okay instead of just a few.
Hi, Thomas. It's Sophie speaking. I just flew to Reykjavik recently and I noticed that Iceland Air are promoting some sort of young experimental bands. I wondered how much of this sort of partnering is going on.
This partnering is going okay. I mean, they are also the big sponsorship of Iceland Airways Festival, and that's also a big stepping stone for the bands. I don't know if you've been to Iceland Airways, but it's like a huge festival and 200 bands are playing, and that is actually one of the biggest stepping stones for the bands in Iceland. And Iceland Air has done a good job of helping the bands get abroad, both through sponsorships and just by having this festival.
So the festival's in October, well, towards the end of October. Yeah. And but we should say Reykjavik's pretty much a music festival most of the year. Is there really a kind of a strong music circuit in Reykjavik?
Yeah, I would say so, compared to how many people live here. I mean, we have concerts every weekend, and I mean, several concerts every weekend. But then in October, when Iceland Airwaves, I mean, just it's like a festival. It's like Christmas for the music industry here. But yeah, I would say so. I mean, we have. I mean, everybody is in a band, you know, one way or the other.
What's always struck me about Iceland and its music is it's pan-generational as well. We don't necessarily think that it's a very young people's scene. I was reading a few days ago about it's a lady called Sigrid Nielsdottir, or Grandma Lo-Fi.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us about her.
I haven't seen the movie yet, but I know that she died last year and they made a documentary about her, and apparently it's getting very good reviews. And she, I think, yeah, she didn't do much else but play music.
She only began to play music and do music from the age of 70, am I right? She for when you read about her, she replicates the sound of a helicopter with an egg whisk and encourages pigeons to coo along with her songs. That sort of, for me, kind of sums up what many would argue is the essential quirkiness of Icelandic music.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
There's something else that I've always thought when you come to think about Icelandic music is musicians don't limit themselves to music at all. There is always a multi-platform effort being made, and it is generally into film. Is that right? Does everybody do every kind of art form?
I mean, a lot of people do. I mean, Gus, I don't know if you know the band. I mean, they're a good example of that. And they used to do everything. I mean, dance and movies and videos and videography and the whole deal. But we have quite a few artists that are, I mean, they're musicians and painters and actors as well. So, yeah.
Right. Well, I think let's have a listen to what you've been with some of your recommendations for us now under review. This is King and Lionheart with Of Monsters and Men. Let's talk about it after we hear it.
Taking over this town. They should worry, but these problems aside, I think I taught you well. That we won't run, and we won't run, and we won't run. That we won't run, and we won't run, and we won't run.
Thomas, you can understand why that's going, well, they've signed to Universal, because it has a very international feeling to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think fans of, you know, bands like Arcade Fire and Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros will definitely love this band.
You said that they've signed a big deal in America, is that right?
They signed a worldwide deal with Universal just a few months ago. And yeah, it was about 2 years ago they won the Battle of the Bands, so things have been moving very fast for these kids. I mean, they're only 20 years old, I think. And, yeah, and somewhere I read they have sold already like 100,000 copies in the U.S. And now they're doing a sold-out tour in the U.S. And they're, yeah, like I said before, they hadn't even been there before, so.
Tell us about the Battle of the Bands in Reykjavik. Is that a really sort of career-making event?
It has been in the last, I would say, like 10 or 15 years. It's a long tradition. I think it's been going on for like 30 years. But bands usually just, if you can say, make it or they get successful within Iceland. They usually don't become international success. For example, I know Sigur Rós actually took part in this competition, you know, before they actually made it. And I mean, they didn't win, but obviously they made it elsewhere.
And Thomas, I wanted to ask you, I mean, Iceland has had, as we all know, some terrible economic problems and, you know, we've seen a kind of age of austerity there in recent months. How has that affected the music scene?
I would say that it's actually helped. I mean, people now have more time to focus on music and doing stuff that they love instead of, you know, competing in the race of, I don't know, quality of life. And, I think the music industry has just benefited from it, really. I mean, more bands are emerging and, I would say it's just been good, actually, for the music.
It's incredible. It's the same thing in the art world. Sometimes austerity makes people more creative. But we're going to have your next recommendation now. This is Retro Stefson with Queen.
And that was Retro Stefson with Queen. Joining us is Thomas Young from Iceland Music Export. Briefly, who are Retro Stefson? They've been around for quite a while. They're very prominent in Iceland, but they haven't travelled very far, have they? Well, their music hasn't travelled.
Well, they signed a deal with Universal in Germany about a year ago, and they've been living in Germany, I think, for a year now. But they've mostly been touring around the mainland of Europe. They're quite a young band as well, and but they're without doubt, like the best live band in Iceland, and they really get the crowd going once they get on stage.
So, what makes them so good live? Because that's obviously a very highly produced piece of music that we just heard.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's actually a new song from their upcoming album. But their earlier stuff is like, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's like heavy metal mixed with African pop music. They actually have two guys in the band who are part African. But they're Icelandic. I mean, they're brought up here and they've lived here all their life. But they really get the crowd going.
That sounds like a big move away then from what they've probably been made famous for.
Exactly. But exactly, I would say so. I mean, they're heading for a new direction, I mean, without doubt. So, but they just really get the crowd going and they can control the crowd really well. I mean, get them to go back and forth and doing all kinds of stupid things. And it's just a really good live show if you ever have the chance.
Thomas, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Thomas Young on the line from Reykjavik from Iceland Music Export. Coming up in a moment on The Review, we'll be doing our paper review. Stay with us.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Sophie Grove.
Now, every Saturday here at Midori House, we pick up some of our favourite magazine titles to rifle through. To help us dissect them, we're joined in the studio by Will Hudson, editor of It's Nice That magazine. Welcome, Will.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us on this rainy Saturday in London.
Yeah, it's not too good.
It's perfect magazine reading weather, though.
True.
Tell us a little bit about It's Nice That.
So It's Nice That started back in April 2007. It started off as a university project. I was studying down in Brighton. Off the back of just putting it out there without any sort of grand plans, it's gradually grown and grown. Off the back of graduating from Brighton, I went and worked in a very traditional graphic design studio for 9 months. Then got a bit frustrated with certain elements with that, left to go and do freelance. It's Nice That was gathering momentum. And then Alex Beck, who's a guy who I went to university with, he bought into the company. And from there, we sort of, with the joint efforts, it's grown to now be seven guys working on the It's Nice That, which covers online, print and a series of events.
So you're effectively a channel for the creative world then, but not just print. This is anything that takes your eye, that you find interesting, you will give it a platform.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's more and more now it's about finding the right way of, it's finding the right platform for the stuff that we find, be it in print, be it online, be it through someone speaking at an event. This week, we've just trialled doing our first podcast. I think sort of audio and radio, I think it's really exciting because I just think you get a different side to people. And I think the challenge now is finding the right way of telling those stories and showcasing that work.
And how do things naturally find their place, either on the printed page or through a set of speakers or through headphones?
I think it's difficult. I think the online is the easiest, quickest, most effective way of putting work out there to a wide audience. We've got it's over 200,000 people now a month who are on the site looking at the work. The magazine's a much smaller number of people that get to see it, but it's the time that goes into the magazine and the things that the magazine allows to do. We can do longer form content. You can show the sort of the visual work that we're showing in a much closer format to how it was originally intended. People didn't create this great work to be seen as sort of 470 by 305 pixels. And I think that's why ultimately the end goal for It's Nice That is trying to show that work in its original format. It's a physical space, it's a gallery space that sort of can showcase that great work.
I've got your latest issue in my hand. I'm just smelling it. It smells lovely.
We get complaints about that sometimes.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, people say.
I really love this. This is like one of the joys of getting a new print off the shelves. And I'm just reading the interview with John Pawson, which is really interesting that you've chosen not to represent him with a portrait. But
I think there is a portrait on the page
there?
Before.
Oh, sorry. Well, that's wrong then. there he is. First. Well, and there's his work, which is which is wonderful. It's a really candid interview and just great that you've got him talking almost just naturally and intimately with the interviewee.
Yeah, I think what we're well aware of with It's Nice That is there's no point in going and doing things that other people are doing in the way that they're doing them. I think if you want to go and read certain interviews with people, there are those magazines with those platforms that are already doing it. I think what we need to do is add value or at least approach things slightly differently. The interviews that we try and do are very informal, sort of dumbs them down a little bit. But they are. It's about just going and meeting these people and having a chat and seeing where it goes.
I must confess, if this is an accurate way of describing it, it seems the least time-pressured magazine I've ever opened for two reasons. First of all, it doesn't seem to have anything very here and now in it. I mean, when you do an interview, about what's on someone's bookshelf. You don't say, what are you reading now? You have, what do you have on your bookshelf? And secondly, I don't think I've read a magazine for a long time which affords its subjects so much physical space on the page. Your interviews will go over pages and pages and pages, and your picture will take an entire page instead of everything being sort of squeezed in.
Yeah, I think if print wasn't so expensive, it'd be a lot more pages and a lot more. I think this is what print allows us to do. It allows us to go and give those interviews a suitable amount of time and length, because I think you engage with magazines differently. You're that much more prepared to go and sit down and read a longer piece of copy. I think what the website allows us to do is concentrate much more on the here and now. It allows us to go and put up the work that's been released that morning, and it's up at 9 o'clock, five, 10 minutes after we found it. Or I think the magazine is, I like that you think it's not as sort of time precious. I'll definitely be sure to tell the guys in the studio that. The magazine allows us to do things differently, and I think we just need to sort of concentrate on what those things are.
And I think by leaving lots and lots of space, it allows you to concentrate fully on what's in front of you.
Yeah.
There's so little distraction in your magazine. It's absolutely beautiful.
Can you tell me about the paper? I mean, I can see as you go through, there's this kind of high gloss, and then there's this a pull-out here with Cyril Porchette. And how do you choose what paper you use, and how do you think that reflects the different sections?
So it's worth saying that Alex Mishakis is the editor of the magazine. We work with a guy called Ryan Mira, who's the art director for it. And I think it's a combination of conversations with, again, it's the best way in which we can show that work. I think when you want to engage with a magazine, it should surprise you sort of page on page. You should turn it and sort of, I think it allows the texture and the way the information is presented. I think it would be all too easy to just pick a paper stock, print it on that, and it just go out there. I think one of the great things that print allows us to do is have a little bit more interaction. It's not a laptop screen or an iPad that you're just presented with that one screen. You can try and do interesting things.
Now, I'm afraid we must move away from the subject of It's Nice That. Although I could sit here, and it's another magazine, but I find myself stroking the magazine again. It's that usual problem that I always have. What have you brought into to tell that you want us to read about at the moment?
Well, there's one that I want you to read about, and then there's one that I guess is more of a talking point than.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a minute.
So the Green Soccer Journal is the first one that I picked, more
Sophie,
because
could
I think
you
pass it's.
Thank you.
I think it's. I like it because it's a football magazine, but it's designed by designers and edited by sort of people with design sensibility. I think all too often you sort of go to the magazine section of newsstands and you just look at design magazine after design magazine. And this actually is a little bit different. It's a little bit more considered. I think the way the photography sort of represents football, the content, it's just different. And I like that about it.
The photography is absolutely beautiful, it has to be said. I mean, the way that some of the football pictures are shot and there's completely sort of symmetrical, wonderful angles that you just never see that in sport photography. It's usually about, you know, people, I mean, understandably, kicking balls around. But this is so, the artistic sensibilities are so original and interesting. Do you think, who are these guys? I mean, they must be football lovers with a very creative bent.
I don't know too much about the guys behind it. From what I know, it's a studio called Junior Junior, and it's designed, edited, published by those guys. It's, I guess, similar to us. It's a small team of people who have got a real sort of passion for what it is that they're doing. But I think you're right. It's across the board. It works. It's the layout and the typography. It's the photographers they work with. It's the illustrators they work with. The actual content, it has good features. They're not the things that you're going to find in the pages of Match magazine or 442. It's a football magazine with a difference.
Again,
and that's why I think it works.
You step back from the immediacy of football, which obviously is, you know, is always sort of results driven and is hungry for the next match and next encounter. But this actually lets you step back and place a little bit of context.
Definitely. And I think, again, I don't want to draw too many parallels between this and what we do, but I think it's not about the sort of the current. It allows a sort of a slightly different angle on football. You're right, it's not a report from the weekend's game. It's not sort of looking ahead.
And it's quite cerebral in the way it's written. I mean, for sport, it's clever, it's kind of play on words, it's kind of poetic in places. Do you think that they're appealing to an audience of people who take their sport so seriously in that as an art form?
Great question. I honestly don't know. I think there's. I don't know. I don't know who picks up this magazine. I don't know if it's designers who have an interest in sport. I don't know if it's football fans who can appreciate good design. I don't know if. I think the cover, it's obviously a football magazine, but you only have to sort of look at a few pages to understand it's not your standard football magazine.
Well, we have to move on, I'm afraid, from these lovely, cerebral, poetic creations to something else that you've brought in. Tell us, we are very short of time, so you're going to have to go at this with your ears back. Why have you brought in what you've brought in?
Right.
And what have you brought in?
I've brought in Take a Break, which I guess is maybe not one that you're expecting. It's purely there to talk about this fact that 791,000 copies of this are sold a week. And one of our big challenges, like I said, we have this audience of 200,000 plus online. We only print 5,000 magazines. We're hitting quite a small percentage of our audience, and we always talk about it in the studio, is that out of our audience, the sort of 2 or 3% that want to go and buy design magazines, prints, everything else, it's 99% want to go to the pub on a Friday night. Mm. So we'd almost be better off doing And It's Nice That Pub than And It's Nice That Magazine. It's just what it's there to talk about is just this idea that we have this audience, we want to produce content that they want to engage with, and I think we just always have to keep that in mind when we look at what we're trying to produce and what we're trying to do.
I suppose it's kind of a philosophical point about whether you should try and sort of pander to the lowest common denominator or kind of like set the agenda and really try and surprise people with new things that they didn't know. I mean, do you think that anyone who would read It's Nice That would actually also read Take a Break?
Definitely. I think that's
you
what's
read
great.
It, don't you? You
no, I, love it, I didn't. When I no, I
your house is full of issues of take a break.
Yeah, no, not quite. It's definitely also the first time that I've been accused of making a philosophical point. I'm not sure. It's. I just think what's so fascinating is that I think it demonstrates there is still an audience that want to buy magazines. I think that even though they are on the decrease, I think it's like almost 10%. Decrease in sales in the second half of 2011, but I think it says that people still want to go and buy that printed thing, however disposable it is. The majority of this content is probably available online. You could find it, but people still want that physical, tangible.
It's kind of like
thing.
The magazine equivalent of cornflakes. You just pick it up, you consume it, you dispose of it, and then you get on with your life.
Yep.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's amazing. Thank you so much for bringing that in, Will. Will be obviously taking this home, especially to read Mum's Boob Job Heartbreak, Did My Breasts Poison My Baby? That's something that I've always worried about, and I'm particularly interested in the pictures of the people who've dressed their dogs up. They look like punk singers. That's the only way I could describe it. You May Now Lick the Bride is the top story there. Thank you very much indeed, Will Hudson, editor of It's Nice That magazine. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
No mundo todo, essa é a Monocle 24. حول العالم هنا مونوكول 24
En todo el mundo esto es Monocle 24
London, New York, Hong Kong y Tokyo es Monocle 24
Από όλο τον κόσμο αυτό είναι το Monocle 24
Bare rund, det här är Monocle 24
Überall auf der Welt, das ist Monocle 24
Det coolaste Monocle 24
Around the world, this is Monocle 24
And we're approaching the final part of this week's review with me, Emma Nelson, and Sophie Grove. Now, this week in London, the ICA on the Mall will host Publish and Be Damned, a fair for alternative and artsy magazines, pamphlets and publications. From Landfill Editions to Preston Is My Paris and Clod, 50 titles will be showcasing their latest offerings to the publishing world.
Earlier, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck caught up with Kit Hammonds, one of the founders of Published and Be Damned.
The first thing I love about this fair is the fact that actually people do want to print things and put things on paper and make things and stitch things and staple things. Are you surprised at the vibrancy of that culture that, you know, in this time when we're told that everyone's going over to digital, all these people could have made a little app or they could have made something that you could look at online, but they have a passion for paper?
Well, I think that's really the point of why we set up Publish and Be Damned, was that it was in 2004, that was the moment before the possibility of PDF publishing had really taken over, but it was clearly on the horizon. And to be honest, we thought it was like a death knell, if you like, or a celebration of a final end of print. But actually what seems to have occurred is through social media, social networks, that actually there's been more print produced. People are able to distribute it more, and also people start to build events and social structures around their publications, which is really the core of what we look at in everything that we do.
What do you think is the community that comes to the publishing like this? Who are the people who are trying to find voice through these pamphlets and through these independent publications?
Well, I'm not sure that the participants would want me to say this, but it's really the oddballs that we're trying to identify, okay. The people who can't fit in anywhere else. And although many of the people who are publishing have quite successful artistic practices within a traditional sort of sculptural or painting setting, what the publishing represents within their practices is a conversation that they have with their peers, an ability to sort of do something different, which isn't bound by traditional sort of expectations of a commercial gallery expectation.
To get into your group and to show in an exhibition like or an event like this, is there any kind of rules and regulations? Do they have to kind of, you know, say that they're not making any money? Do they have to be, you know, only publishing a few hundred of each magazine?
There's no rule. It's more of a rule of thumb, if you like, okay. That we try to concentrate on people who are publishing regular journals. So it's more magazines and fanzines, journals or periodical publishing. And in that sense that it's not individual artists presenting their work within a book format, but that the magazines themselves are a space for lots of different things to take place. But it's a grey area around the edge of that, because we look for, as I said, the oddballs.
And the print runs of these people, is it from, you know, the tens to the hundreds?
Yes, very much so. I mean, people do print longer runs, but then they find it difficult to distribute them, which is where, again, the fair started, was really this problem of one could print, but find the money to print. Now that, but how do you get rid of them once you've got them?
Now, without you getting you into trouble, just tell me one or two of the publications that you think are particularly interesting.
Well, within the fair, I think one of the old classics that we have is a magazine called Control, which is in an issue about 16 or 17, but it's been published since the 60s, so it comes out once every 3 years, with an artist called Stephen Willett, who actually has his studio just round the corner from this studio. And he's a very interesting artist, been working over a long period of time, very involved in sort of social issues. The magazine is called Control because it's about taking control over one's own art activity. At the opposite end of the scale, you mentioned Preston Is My Paris, is one of my favourites, which is now much more traditional and it looks like a magazine and they do editions. But started the first time we presented it in our fair a few years ago, it was a single sheet of A4 photocopied with a picture and a very small piece of text. And so it's a very broad spread.
And is the title descriptive of what's in that magazine? So Preston, for listeners around the world, is a kind of northern industrial town. And is it a celebration of the town or is it a celebration of a person called Preston?
No, it was a celebration of the town, very much. A kind of parodic celebration of the town, I think. It was loving, but not necessarily without irony.
And you said that this has remained a kind of really vibrant corner of publishing. Do you think that actually in the time when everything is digital, that people find going to print actually a bit more revolutionary in a way, that doing something on paper feels a bit more old school and that you can say something a bit different to when everyone else is rushing to digital?
I think there's that, but there's also a case of one comes across it differently in a browsing sense. I think it's people who believe that you can move from one thing to another without the need for a Google search, which is based around language, you know, and keywords, that actually coming across something you would never expect and is actually something that's not facilitated online, strangely, that there's a huge amount of information out there, but it's channeled through the words that people use. And so within a bookshop, you might pick up Jane Austen next to Automobile Mechanics, and that kind of clash of material is really, I think, what people involved in publishing now respond to.
And how do these people get their magazines out to anybody? How do they find an audience for them? The where you're holding the event, the Institute of Contemporary Art is well known for having its little bookshop and magazine collection. It's great to make a, Preston Is My Paris, for example, but then how does he or she then find an audience for that?
A lot of it's to do with communicating with peer groups. So actually Publishing Me Damned is one of the tools, which is as much about bringing together all these publishers into one space at any one time so that they can have conversations, as it is about promoting to the public, if you like. It's quite like a jumble sale in that sense, that it's built around the idea that a community might recycle and support itself, rather than the idea that we're not the borders of, I think, presume I can say borders, defunct these days.
They've gone now.
But yeah, exactly. But it's not that kind of, it's not about selling and trying to find a market and catering to a market that's defined through advertising, etc.
And that was Kit Hammonds, one of the founders of Published and Be Damned, which is happening at London's ICA this afternoon. This is the review on Monocle 24.
You're heading off there straight away now, aren't you?
I am. I'm going to nip down there, I think.
That brings us to the end of today's Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here. The show is produced by Dawn Trump and Katie Bilboa. Research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our sound engineer was Katie Bilboa. You can catch the best of the week's stories with Hugo McDonald on The Curator, which is up next. Don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly too, which will be on air tomorrow at 11 a.m. London time. Sophie, you're doing that, aren't you?
Yeah.
So is Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. But from all of us on The Review, have a great weekend.